I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about really continuing our conversation about the Declaration of Independence in celebration of America's 250th anniversary. We are having a series of conversations on the Declaration, on its origins, its writing, and its legacy. Today, we're going to be talking about something that you don't hear a lot about when you're talking about and thinking about the Declaration, and that is the moral character, the virtues, the qualities, the habits, the dispositions that are assumed by and needed for the Declaration of Independence. I'm joined for that conversation today by Dr. Adam Seagrave. Adam is currently Director of Teacher Programs for the Ashbrook Center. Formerly, he was, until very recently, Associate Professor of Civic and Economic Thought at the School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership at Arizona State University, that wonderful institute there. He is a widely published author on topics connected with America and American political thought. His book called Race in the American Story, out by Oxford University Press, The Foundations of Natural Morality on the Compatibility of Natural Rights and the Natural Law. And he's also published works, Liberty and Equality, The American Conversation, and even an edition of The Federalist called The Accessible Federalist from Hackett. So we're talking to someone here today who really knows America and American political thought for this conversation that I'm calling, Are Americans a Declarational People? Adam, thanks for joining us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff, and hosting me. And thanks so much for that that introduction. I really, I'm really happy to be here and to have this conversation with you.
So most people, when they think about the Declaration of Independence, they think about, and I think justly so, they think about those really famous words of the second sentence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A kind of philosophical statement, almost, one might say, of America. But it is interesting to me, thinking about the topic for today, that the Declaration, that's not how it starts. It starts when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. It talks about Americans as one people, as though we're not just an idea, but we're a people with an idea. This idea of the you seem to have been making an argument in your teaching and in your thinking and in your published works that if we're going to understand America properly and the legacy of the Declaration, we need to understand it philosophically, but we also need to understand the kind of people it envisions. Help me understand that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you're right to point to that first opening line of the Declaration and its reference to a people. And I think of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as an appropriate takeoff point for the way I'm thinking about the Declaration in terms of bringing something into birth, bringing a people into birth, all of the metaphors, the language relating to birth in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, that 1776, with the Declaration of Independence, the American people was born. And I think that that's the way Lincoln conceives of it. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. We tend to think of the Declaration of Independence, as you said, more in terms of its famous lines, its famous phrases, all men are created equal, et cetera. And we think of it as a historical document that was written at a particular period in time, which it was, of course, and written for a particular historical purpose, which it was. But I think what Lincoln points us to is the fact that in addition to being a historical document, the Declaration is also is also present in a real way in the United States at every moment of our national existence. Or I guess I should say, at least it should be present. It should be present as an inspiration for us. It should be present as a touchstone for our politics. It should be present as a lodestar to give direction to our policies. And it should be present as a way of shaping the habits of heart and mind of the American people in an ongoing way. In other words, it should be, to borrow a phrase from constitutional interpretation, the Declaration should be a living document in our political culture. And I think that's what Lincoln really did in his statesmanship. And I think that it's important to view the Declaration in that way as we celebrate its 250th anniversary.
So let's start thinking about that a little bit. The habits of heart and mind that you were referring to, the virtues, the qualities that the Declaration envisions in the American people, that it needs in the American people in order to be a living influence on our public life. Let's start with some of those. What are some of those really important habits of the heart?
So I think that actually, and this may be surprising to some of our listeners, but I would actually point to three virtues in particular, three dispositions that I think the Declaration requires of a declarational people. And those virtues are the virtues of faith, hope, and love. And those, I know those are theological virtues, and so it might seem strange that the Declaration would point to those. The Declaration, of course, is not explicitly a religious document. It doesn't refer specifically to a particular religious tradition. It is a theistic document in its references to the creator, multiple references, explicit and indirect, to a creator of some kind. It's also a spiritual document in the sense that it points us to the importance of principles and realities that are not material or visible or tangible in front of us. So the references to the laws of nature and nature's God in the first paragraph, the reference to inalienable rights, those are things that are, you might say, mystical or spiritual realities that are not present to us in the same way that our physical existence, material comforts, things like that are present to us, but they're nevertheless important principles to guide our practical life. So when I say faith, when I say that a declarational people has to be a people of faith, I don't necessarily mean it has to be a religious people, but it does have to be a people that views immaterial principles as important for guiding practice.
Okay, yeah. That's very interesting to me. So you're saying there's a faith. When I think of faith, faith, hope, and love, those three cardinal virtues, faith means I have put my trust in something, I believe in something, maybe that I can't see, but that I believe or know is real. What faith is the Declaration asking of the American people?
So I think that the Declaration is asking the American people to take seriously those principles that it enunciates that are not present from a sensible physical standpoint. So the fact that there are laws of nature, there are moral principles that should guide our political practice, that flies in the face of, say, a Machiavellian understanding of politics, which views as important the things that you can touch and feel and see. Machiavelli famously lays stress on those kind of material, visible manifestations of political power, right? What matters is what's actually real in the sense of physically present to us. The Declaration presents a very different vision of politics than the Machiavellian vision. It's idealist, not in the sense of being anti-realist, but it points to the importance of ideas, right? The importance of ideas that are not directly sensible. They're not physically present to us. We have to remind ourselves of them, be educated in them, and really allow them to inform the way we view the world in order for them to be effective in guiding our practice. So that's more what I mean. And this is something that Martin Luther King Jr. was very good about pointing this out, the importance of spiritual principles and guiding practice. So he He pointed to often the battle between injustice and justice in the world, for example, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. He talked about the forces of light and the forces of darkness being at war in the American civil rights era. What did he mean by that? I mean, he meant that there was a sort of spiritual backdrop to the issues of his time that were manifesting themselves in practical ways. But King thought, and I think he was picking up on the Declaration's stance in this way, he thought that it was important for people to have a certain spiritual disposition towards those events and towards those political realities that would give them a perspective on it, right? A perspective to evaluate things effectively and act effectively in practice. So I think that's what the Declaration points to, and that's what I mean by a faith, right? We have to have faith that there are principles and ideas that should be important in guiding our political practice.
And if I'm not mistaken, Abraham Lincoln referred to this as our ancient faith.
That's right. That's right. Yep. Yeah. I think Lincoln was very much attuned to this aspect of the Declaration. Yep.
Okay. So that's the first one. We have to have a disposition to embrace this notion that there are moral realities that we can't see, including things like a person is an individual who has a right to life, liberty, and property, or pursuit of happiness, right? That's really true. And we really have to respect that. They have a certain dignity because of that. Mm-hmm. The second virtue you mentioned is hope. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems true that Americans are kind of a famously optimistic people. The glasses always seem to be half full for Americans. But is that what you mean by hope, or is it something a little different?
I think it's a little different. It's similar to that. It does manifest, I think, in optimism at times, but it's a little different. And I think, again, I would point to Lincoln and King here as two really good representatives of the Declaration's hopefulness. And that is that the Declaration Statement of Principles, it's both a statement of fact in the sense that these are truths. We hold these truths to be self-evident. They are true at the time in which they're written, but at the same time, they're aspirational. So Lincoln, of course, points to the aspirational nature of the Declaration's principles, that the people who wrote it and adopted it at the time didn't understand it to be able to be enacted and fulfilled at that moment when they were writing it. They thought that it would be a guidepost for future generations to fulfill more perfectly. Similarly, King refers to the arc of the moral universe bending toward justice, right? That there's this sort of aspirational hope that our reality, our present reality, will closer and closer mirror the ideal that we know to be true, right? That we know to be what we should be striving for. So I think that's the kind of hope that the Declaration points us towards. So it is in a way a sort of optimism, but more I think it's deeper than that. I think it is deeper than that. It's again related to the faith that there is a reality behind the reality of our circumstances and time that is more powerful than whatever is going on in this moment, and that is leading us towards greater fulfillment of our ideals. So there really is, I mean, it's a pretty robust sort of disposition, I think, that one has to have to align with the Declaration's virtue of hope. And I think Frederick Douglass actually was one of the best exemplars of the Declaration's dispositional character of hope. That Douglass was an optimist, but he was an optimist in a kind of deep sense.
Let's think a little bit about that. It's interesting you said Frederick Douglass, because that's exactly what was going through my mind when you were talking about this virtue of hope, because I'm thinking about the famous speech of his, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," right? Or he is excoriating the Americans of his day for the practice of slavery, for being deeply corrupted by the institution of slavery, and really almost forgetting their faith, their political principles. How is a person like Frederick Douglass, given his very clear-sighted understanding of reality and how far America had fallen short, how is he hopeful?
I think the 4th of July speech is just a really striking example of the depth of Douglass's hope, because as you said, he's extremely aware of and sensitive to the enormity of the evil and injustice present in the America of his time. He doesn't pull any punches in condemning it. And yet he juxtaposes that clear-sighted awareness of the evil in his time with a very, very deep and a strong sense throughout of hopefulness. And it really starts early on in that speech when he refers to the Declaration of Independence as containing saving principles early in that speech. And then he returns to it at the very end of the speech in his very, very hopeful, optimistic final paragraph, where he says that the fiat of the Almighty has not yet spent its force. And I think that part of what he means by that is the saving principles of the Declaration. And so I think that Douglass, he thinks that there's a, you know, like, again, like King, there's this sort of underlying direction to the moral universe, as you might say, that is guided by some sort of higher power in Douglass's mind, as it is in King's mind. But it's connected to the principles enunciated in the Declaration, that humanity has a nature. We are able to understand what that nature is, and we are able to better and better respect and fulfill our human nature in our community over time. So I think that, yeah, the 4th of July speech is such a great example of that. And so it's not, and it distinguishes Douglass's optimism from a kind of superficial optimism or a sanguine, you know, everything's going to be fine, don't worry about it. That's not the optimism he's talking about.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it. It's so tempered with that knowledge. And it strikes me as another aspect of this hope, or another articulation of this hope. I'm thinking of Lincoln's fragment on the Constitution and Union, where, and I'll just read a bit of it here. He's talking about the cause of America's prosperity. And he says, well, it is the Union and the Constitution, but he says it's something else. Entwining itself more closely about the human heart, that something is the principle of liberty to all. The principle that clears the path for all, gives hope to all, and by consequence, enterprise and industry to all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that the kind of hopefulness that it's an optimism, as you say, rooted in a deeper hope that the day of justice is coming, and because this country is fundamentally just or supposed to be just?
Yes. Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. And you're right. I think, yeah, Lincoln's statement in that fragment really, really articulates what I mean by that. That, yeah, and I think Lincoln refers to it there as sort of the principle of liberty to all is standing behind, right? It's sort of standing behind everything and informing reality in a deep way. So, yeah, I think Lincoln has that perspective as well, that, again, that we might not see it. Right. We might not see reasons for hope in our current political situation and climate. And yet, I think Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, and other great Americans who were attuned to the Declaration's principles, yet they had that hope still. Right. Even without evidence of it in their current time, they knew that it was there standing behind. And so, yeah. And so I think that it has to be a hope that's informed by that, by a kind of faith, again, by the kind of faith that there are important realities that are unseen, that we don't necessarily experience directly or with our senses. Human nature is one of those, that individual human beings exist. We're all around, but there's also something called humanity. There's an idea of humanity, that we have to sort of keep in front of our mind's eye in order to maintain that hopefulness in the face of what are often discouraging practical circumstances.
So the third disposition or virtue that you mentioned, faith, hope, and love. I think probably a number of our listeners are thinking, wait, love? How is love part of politics?
Exactly. Right. Yeah, no, it wouldn't immediately come to mind. But I do think that is where the Declaration is pointing ultimately. And here, so one connection we might make is with civic friendship, right? So if the Declaration brings a people into being, a people has to be joins together through some sort of civic friendship. However you define that, whatever its components are, there has to be that glue between people that allows them to have goodwill for their fellow citizens and to feel themselves as part of a unit in their community. So that's part of it, is civic friendship. I think it's connected with the Declaration's identification of what we might call human dignity, right? The inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That human beings, every person has a dignity that is inherent, right? That is, that they're born with, or that's given to them by their nature, by the Creator. That's a really, really important thing. And I think that recognizing that one's fellow citizens, one's fellow community members have this inherent dignity that the Declaration expresses, that should inspire a kind of love. And of course, we don't mean, you know, a romantic love or even a love of, you know, of friend, you know, type friendship or anything like that.
Yeah, doesn't mean I have to like all my fellow citizens?
Exactly, right. No, it doesn't mean you have to like your fellow citizens, right? And you can, obviously, you can disagree with them strenuously, and you can dislike them at times, and you can dislike your fellow citizens. But at the same time, you can love them in a deeper way. You know, of course, people in various religious traditions are familiar with how that's possible. And Martin Luther King, again, spoke eloquently about this when he referred to the kind of love that he was inculcating in his followers, this kind of agape love, right? You love someone because God loves them. And I think a version of that is present in the Declaration, right? That you have a certain love for other human beings because they have this inherent dignity, they have inalienable rights, and they're created equal in an important sense with yourself. So I think that's the kind of love that the Declaration really requires of its people in order to live out a politics in accordance with it. And that's the kind of love that would underlie a civic friendship that the American people brought about by the Declaration should have.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
So talk a little bit more about that civic friendship. What's it built on? Because we've seen in history around the world, we've seen, unfortunately, in our own times, we have seen societies even within themselves torn apart sometimes in the worst ways by civil war, mm-hmm. right? It happened certainly in the United States. It's happened in countries around the world where civic friendship either didn't exist or it existed but was torn apart, mm-hmm. and the bonds of friendship did not hold. Talk a little bit more about the bonds of that civic friendship.
Right. Well, and in the case of our Civil War, that's a clear instance where it was preceded by widespread denial of the truth of the Declaration's principles, right? By many in the South, openly denied that the truths in the Declaration were self-evident and said that they were actually lies, right? So that paved the way for the Civil War in our country. But I think that one thing civic friendship does, and one way it manifests is in civil discourse, right? Is in a propensity to, or a disposition to solve problems through conversation, through discussion, through dialogue, through compromise when necessary, rather than through force. I think that that's one of the primary ways it manifests. And I think that there's been a renewed emphasis on civil discourse in many ways in our society, which is a good thing. But I think sometimes we don't understand it in as deep of a sense as the Declaration would point us to. And what I mean by that is that we tend to think that civil discourse or civic friendship, for that matter, means just, you know, treating someone else's opinions with respect. In other words, thinking that their opinions are worth listening to and hearing, which it is in one sense. But I think in a deeper sense, it's about respecting the person who's expressing those opinions, really recognizing their inherent dignity and value in a conversation or in a dialogue with them. So having a disposition towards dialoguing with others that reflects the Declaration's vision of the dignity of the human person. So which again is related to, but different than just saying, well, I'm going to listen quietly to your opinion and say I respect your opinion before I proceed to respond in a way that is disrespectful or that doesn't really take it seriously, doesn't take you seriously as an interlocutor, or that disregards what you just said, right? So I think too often we think of civil discourse in a more superficial way than what the Declaration would point us to.
That's so interesting to me, because I wonder if the Declaration of Independence, on the one hand, I'm thinking about important works of American political thought like Federalist Number 10, where Madison says, well, faction is thus sown in the very nature of man. So there's a kind of realistic appraisal of human beings as, you know, we're going to disagree, we're going to fight, we're going to argue, there's going to be conflict. That's the nature of free people. But you're saying, in opposition to that, or underlying that, there is this love or this civic friendship.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think that civic friendship doesn't mean that people don't form factions, right? It doesn't mean that people won't form factions and disagree with each other and have fundamentally different interests, as Madison points out there as well, that will influence their opinions. People are influenced by self-love, of course, too, which attaches them to their opinions, and leads to difficulties in navigating disagreements. So, yeah, so I think that all of that can coexist, though, with civic friendship. And it is a friendship at a deeper level. And it doesn't mean, again, it doesn't mean that you have to like the person you disagree with. It doesn't even mean that, you know, you disagree now and then later you go out for a drink or something and everything's hunky-dory and you're friendly. It could mean that, but it doesn't even necessarily mean that. It means that I recognize the value, the immense value of the person who I disagree with, even if I disagree with them, think they're wrong, have different interests than they do. I still recognize their value as a person, their inalienable rights, and I respect that in them. And I think that might seem like it doesn't make a difference, but I think practically it really does. I think that having that disposition has the power to change the way conversations go and to shape relationships. And I think, for example, that was a big part of King's success in his leadership of the civil rights movement was that people recognized that that's what he was trying to reflect. That he was trying to reflect a kind of deeper vision of human dignity. And so that even if it was in the context of conflict over policy, that he was pointing to the importance of this deeper level of civic friendship. And that led to policy progress, right? Because it was, I think people recognized that. I think society recognized what he was pointing to. So, yeah, so I think that's right. That civic friendship can and should go along with factional disagreements that will, of course, continue to exist in any free society.
So as I take it, what you're saying is for a declarational principle, it means that we, of course, draw our principles from the Declaration of Independence, but we also draw, I'll call it, I guess the word from Alexis de Tocqueville would be mores, which he says is the whole moral and intellectual state of a people, or we might say today culture. So we have our principles as Americans. We have an American culture, you're saying, of faith, hope, and love in this way, connected to the Declaration's principles. Mm-hmm. What place in our declarational people, what place does history and a shared history have in our culture of faith, hope, and love?
So I think it has a very important place, right? So, and this, you know, this gets to how we teach history in schools, and what, you know, what the popular understanding of American history is, which has been a huge point of contention in recent years, as you know, and leads to a lot of our culture war battles recently. How do we understand our history? And you know, again, you know, to Lincoln's phrase of the mystic cords of memory, right? That it's important that people have a common memory, at least to some degree. And I think that has been missing. That's been missing in recent years. And I think that undermines, when it's missing, it undermines civic friendship. It undermines love. I think particularly that disposition that the Declaration points us to. It also, of course, can undermine hope. If we don't have a clear vision of our past, it's hard to have a unified and clear vision of the future. If we don't know where we've come from, it's hard to know sometimes where we're going or where we should be going. So I think that is really important. I think we have to have a shared historical memory as a Declaration people. Part of that, of course, involves the Declaration itself and the history of the Declaration. I think that's a key part of it, right? Why is it that we think the Declaration is important in American history? Can we agree on that, right? Can we all agree on the importance and relevance of the Declaration in our shared historical memory? I think, again, in recent years, that's been a difficulty, and hopefully the anniversary and the renewed attention to the Declaration can repair that, some of that common shared understanding of the Declaration. So I think the Declaration itself is a very important part of that shared historical memory, but it does go much farther than that. I think, we have to be teaching American history in an accurate, thorough, balanced, non-ideological way in order to ensure that we do have that shared memory. I think that's absolutely crucial to being one people. Yeah.
And interesting, the dispositions you've talked about in this culture, as you're describing it, and shared memory, a lot of that has to do with how Americans think about themselves and each other. In other words, it's inward looking in that sense. What does it mean to be a declarational people as we look out on the rest of the world?
Yeah, so I think if we look at the first paragraph of the Declaration, obviously it points to that outward facing nature of the Declaration's purpose, that is reference to the decent respect for the opinions of mankind, that the Declaration was published, yeah, really for the world, right? And for foreign audiences. Thinking about the particular historical context, right? Thinking about European powers like France or Spain, you know, who would help us win the war against the British. And so it had that purpose at the time. And I think it has continued to have that outward facing purpose since. From the perspective of a Declaration people and the virtues of a Declaration people, I think also it points us all the way back to Winthrop's speech and his reference to the city on a hill, right? So this idea of America's purpose in human history. And I know that's a controversial idea, especially when it's put in terms of American exceptionalism or the idea that America is somehow better than other countries or has a special purpose in the world. But I think there are also versions of Winthrop's basic idea that, that might be less controversial, that as a people, that America has a responsibility to not only treat foreign nations well, but also to be an example in some form. And I think that's simply been the case in American history, that our Declaration and our Revolution inspired revolutions elsewhere, inspired declarations of independence elsewhere around the world. And so it has been that it has had that outward facing effect. Of course, it did in France most directly, and obviously that led to, you know, had some complications there. But I think it's, you know, that's always been the case, whether we like it or not, that the Declaration has had a global impact. So I think that we should be attentive to that too, from the standpoint of ensuring that our political culture is as healthy as it can be, right? And that we are ourselves representing the virtues that the Declaration requires as a people.
Yeah. I was thinking that, and I have to ask that as we close. You are a keen observer of American political culture and American political thought, including contemporary American political culture. Are you optimistic about the persistence of this culture of faith, hope, and love? Because I think a lot of people look around the country today and say, we are deeply divided, very polarized. Politics and American public life more broadly seems, at least, very bitter. Social media seems to exacerbate the bitterness of things. You hear that criticism a lot around the country. In the face of that, what is your thought about the future of this declarational people?
I'd say I'm hopeful.
Well, that's a good American response. Yeah. Why are you? Because I think a lot of people look at the situation today and don't find a lot of grounds for hope.
Right, right. Yeah. And I think, and I wouldn't necessarily say I'm optimistic in the sense that there isn't a lot that I can point to in our culture right now that's the reason to be optimistic. I think there are things here and there. I do think that recent renewed attention to civic education, I think, has been really, really beneficial and does give grounds for hope. I think in recent years, I mean, the starting of our school at ASU, as you mentioned, that has been that it kicked off a movement in higher education to have a renewed attention to education and civic principles around the country. I think that's grounds for hope. I think the work of the Ashbrook Center and what the Ashbrook Center has been doing and its continued success and growth, that's grounds for hope. I think that movement that really has been gaining ground in the last 10 years or so, especially, that those are reasons for hopefulness. And, you know, I work with teachers, really honored to work with teachers almost every day in my work in the Ashbrook Center. And that always gives me grounds for hope as well, just to see how many really, really dedicated, passionate, and virtuous, in the sense that I'm talking about, virtuous teachers there are out there who really care about the work they're doing and really are doing an excellent job of it. I think that's grounds for hope as well. So I would point to that, I think we'll see the effects of that over time. I think our politics is still really dysfunctional, obviously. I mean, right now is a, you know, particularly frustrating moment in that respect. But I think if we look at that movement in civic education and the work that we're doing in the Ashbrook Center and the teachers I see every day, that gives me grounds for hope.
Well, that I love that conclusion. I think to continue to use your words, we have faith in these things, that once people understand these principles and our shared history, that they can embrace that and we can sort of move forward as a people. Well, Adam, what a fascinating, interesting discussion on the Declaration and its legacies as we see it in Americans as a declarational people. Adam Seagrave, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.